You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. As I've mentioned before, my new book on the Russo-Ukrainian War is out on Amazon. It is unique, to say the very least. And the garbage in book form now is already starting to flood the mainstream presses. I'm very proud of it, and I've done a tremendous amount of work, putting it all together over the last, 2 years, whatever it was. It's been a long time. We're not going to talk about that today. Today's date is, the 25th of January, 2026. We're going to talk about Peter the Great, my next book. I have several books, swirling in my head. I guess I'm easily bored. Is going to be on Peter the Great. And this is an issue that I'm not entirely sure I'm going to include in it. It's called The Man in the Iron Mask. What if Peter the Great never returned from his great embassy, 1697 to 1698? I mean, a lot of pre-modern monarchies have various hoaxes and false claimants to the throne. Russia was specifically susceptible to this phenomenon. A false Tsar Dmitry came to rule Russia directly during the time of troubles. And several fake Peter III's caused major wars years later. So the concept of a false monarch had been ingrained into the Russian consciousness. There were other very minor ones before. But this is a contentious theory, and I can't say I'm 100% behind it yet. That at some point in his tour of Western Europe, fairly early in his reign, he was kidnapped and substituted for another one. There is presently a minority of professional historians in Russia who accept the theory. Almost none do in the West, or even realize it's a theory. Prior to electronics or photography, a plan like this may actually work in practice. Today would be far more difficult. The only people that a fake would have to worry about would be the immediate family. Let's talk about the nature of the Grand Embassy. It was a fairly unique event in European history. No Russian monarch had ever visited Europe before. Peter the Great sought to study certain European practices up close, specifically the shipbuilding techniques of the Dutch, among many other things. It started on March 9th, 1697, and the number of people who were in this embassy, I can't get a firm number. It goes from 20 to 300. Figure if it's the Tsar of Russia, although he did not use his real name, it would be a fairly large number. They departed for Riga, and Peter is listed as a member of the embassy only as a private soldier and policeman. The name he used was Peter Mikhailov. Now, technically, the official diplomatic purpose of the embassy was to create a coalition against the Ottoman Empire. But Peter made no secret about what he really wanted. Not to mention the fact that he wanted to select foreign specialists to bring back to build his new Russia. In Riga, the Tsar was allowed to inspect the fortress, but to his surprise, he wasn't allowed to take any measurements. They went to Courland, in today's coastal region of Lithuania and Latvia. This comes up in later monarchs with that. It was Anna of Courland. Peter met with the Dutch ruler, Frederick Casimir. The prince tried to persuade Peter to join his coalition against Sweden. In Königsberg, Peter visited the Frederiksberg fortress. He attended artillery courses and even graduated with a diploma certifying that the ruler of Russia, quote, acquired mastery as a bombardier and skill in the use of firearms. And what they mean is heavy weapons at the time. I think most people had figured out who he was, but we can't be 100% sure. The substitution of the real Peter and his capture quite possibly occurred during his trip to Amsterdam with the Grand Embassy, but no one's quite sure. Peter was 26. Yes, he was tall, but he was just above average. He was very healthy, had a stocky build. He had a mole on his left cheek. He had wavy hair, was very well educated, and at that point, a lover of all things Russian Orthodox, and he was a pious man. Less than 2 years later, a man returns who speaks very little Russian, doesn't like Russia, never even learned to write in Russian for the rest of his life, and apparently forgotten everything he knew prior leaving for the Grand Embassy. And the skills that he brought back wasn't just something that you could take a course on and get a diploma. No, things that required years of training. He had no mole on his left cheek. His hair became straight. And the man who returned was sickly, maybe looking something like 40 years old. Now, I'm not sure what picture Sven is going to choose for to go along with this talk. I've found many before and after, you know, within a year, paintings of what Peter was just before he left and what Peter was just when he returned. And I think that's the strongest evidence. They don't look alike. The very strongest evidence I can find. I mean, obviously, it's true that 2 years of absence, you know, he's a young man. It's funny that the Grand Embassy's papers make no mention of Mihailov, especially Mihailov contracting a fever. This is something else. They all knew who Mihailov was. But the man who was sickly, the guy who returned was sickly. He had chronic fever, and he bore traces of a prolonged exposure to mercury, which then was the main treatment for tropical fever. After returning, the Peter or false Peter, during naval battles, he demonstrated an extensive experience in boarding combat, which has very specific characteristics and can only be mastered through a lot of experience and a lot of training. It doesn't happen overnight, and certainly doesn't happen in the year and a half that he was gone, suggesting that the man who returned was an experienced sailor who participated in many naval battles and sailed extensively in the southern seas. Well, before he left, Peter had never been in any naval battles. And really, Russia had no access to the sea except the White Sea, which isn't exactly tropical. The young Peter quite possibly was terrified of the sea, and for very good reason. the age of 20, he nearly drowned near Arkhangel. He's going to visit the Solovyetsky Monastery. May 18, 1694, Peter arrived in Arkhangel from Vologda. He traveled by small boats in the first leg. The Tsar, along with boyars and Archbishop Afanasy of Arkhangel, then sailed in a normal royal barge or yacht to Solovyetsky. The wind was favorable, but it gradually increased and finally became a storm. The helmsman was a peasant, Antipapanov, who was quite experienced with the area. He steered the royal barge into Unskaya Bay. The entrance was treacherous, lots of underwater rocks, but he knew where he was going. And he saved them from an almost certain death. The royal yacht was moored at Dominski Monastery. The Tsar bestowed many gifts on Antipa personally and the monastery itself, granting him a pension, in fact, until his death. He even made a cross with his own hands, which is still there, erected it on a spot where initially where he had come ashore because, you know, those small boats had eventually crashed. And then he prayed in thanksgiving for hours, giving new lands and everything else. So the guy almost drowns in a storm. Peter was not a secular man and was no fan of the water. Now, initially, he missed his wife, Tsarina Eudoxia. He wrote quite frequently while he was away, but when he gets back, he didn't even see her. He didn't give any reasons whatsoever. He sent her away to a monastery. And by the way, she was the last full Russian, ethnically, to serve as the wife of the Tsar. Of the, 100, 250, 25, whoever you listen to, of that initial embassy, only two people returned. No one's quite sure what happened to the rest of them. Let's go with it. 20 men is like the standard. Two returned. Prince Alexander Menshikov and Peter or false Peter. The rest had disappeared. Menshikov, who figures greatly in this story, was one of the most corrupt men in Russian history, and Peter never spoke of what happened to these other men. Now, Peter's half-sister, Tsarina Sofia, raised the army in Moscow, the Streltsy, the elite archer corps protecting the Kremlin, against what she thought was an imposter. I mean, these military men had other reasons to rebel, to be sure, but was brutally suppressed. Sofia herself was hanged from the Spassky Gate at the Kremlin. Peter went on a killing spree, killing his younger half-brother Ivan V and several of his younger children. Then later, he executes his youngest son, Alexei, without mercy. And I recommend you look up the 1871 painting by Nikolai G.E. Peter interrogates his son at Peterhof. It's very emotional. But immediately upon the Tsar's return, all the daily records of Peter's childhood and youth, which chronicles every step of his life, receptions with ambassadors, etc., disappeared from the court archives. The Peter that returned acted as a conqueror. Now, the concept of self-government, whether it be the mir or the zemstvo, especially the zemstvo, the county government, was canceled by Peter. It was only resurrected by Alexander II. It was all replaced by a bureaucratic apparatus of foreigners who were not the best examples of their German or Dutch background. They were debauched He vigorously imposed this rule. He transferred peasants to the ownership of the nobility. They were almost semi-slaves under Peter. That was eventually blamed on Ivan IV, which is not true. That was the only time Russia actually knew serfdom in the normal sense of the term. Now, if you have listened to me at all in the last 15 years, Peter declared war on the Orthodox Church, the bearers of Russian culture. And he lived, to be very nice about it, a secular life. He's the man who introduced smoking and alcohol consumption. And, some of these old calendarists should note, vigorously changed the ancient Russian calendar. He ordered all Russian chronicles to be taken to St. Petersburg and to be burned. He called on an army of German professors to write a completely different Russian history, starting with things like the Norman thesis of Russia's origins, which I have dealt with in other places. In other words, he turned the peasants into an estate or a class. He then completely remade the Russian written language. It had 40 or more characters any given time. Then he introduced 38 characters of Cyril and Methodius. The original had 49 letters. Cyril and Methodius, the great saint, shortened it to 44. Yaroslav the Wise shortened it to 40, to 43. Peter reduced it to 38. Even Nicholas II did reduce it to 35, under the Soviets to 33. And he completely destroyed the Streltsy. So the army had to be rebuilt from the bottom up, at least the elite forces. Now, whether they were actually elite forces or not is a separate matter, but they did hold a lot of power in Moscow. So then with all of this, even if part of these are true, could it be that this wasn't Peter at all? The argument is that Peter could have been captured and imprisoned in a Swedish fortress. He managed to get a letter to Charles XII, King of Sweden, who rescued him. Together they organized a campaign against the imposter, but the entire Masonic fraternity of Europe called upon to fight along with Russian troops, and they won the victory at Poltava. At least this is one version of it. The real Russian Tsar was captured again and imprisoned far away, this time in the Bastille. There's a theory that he is the man in the Iron Mask, or it really was a leather or a velvet one, and that the defeat, Charles XII fled to Turkey. But throughout this period of time, most peasants, especially old believers, saw this man as an imposter. And this is why the German historians, Miller, Bayer, Schlotzer, Kuhn, rewrote Russian history. It was a Russian film made not that long ago called Peter I, The History of His Kidnapping, Evidence of Forgery in the Official History. It's unknown to Western audiences, but it is significant. And one quote from the film is this. In 1698, a prisoner appeared in the Bastille whose face was constantly hidden by a mask. According to one version, it was velvet. According to another, it was leather. Well, thanks to Dumas and Voltaire, though this is a man in the Iron Mask, behind which hid a certain twin brother of King Louis IV, possibly, or Cardinal Mazarin. But there are other versions. It could have been Peter I, with a very strange number. He was prisoner number 6448901. I'm quoting here. Entries in the diaries of the prison warden, the St. Mars, have survived. This prisoner was tall, taller than normal in Europe, held himself with great dignity, and was ordered to be treated as a person of noble birth. His age, height, and other attributes were entirely consistent with the Russian Tsar. We'll get back to that in a bit. Didn't this seem to be an odd number? And how many prisoners were there in France? It seems to be a ridiculously large number. I don't know what that possibly could refer to. But it's in the paintings that struck me the most. His hair is not going to change that radically in a year and a half. The mole's not going to disappear. And by the way, the man who returned was 6 feet, 8 inches, which was bizarre at the time. We know he was a tall guy. Peter the Great was tall to begin with. But things like the oval of his face, the set of his head, the size of his eyes, hairline. No, that's not going to change in a year and a half. The Tsar who left the Grand Embassy, he favored traditional Russian clothing. Even working at the shipyard, he did. One of the authors who agree with this theory, Dmitry Guzevich, he says, indeed, Peter left with the Grand Embassy, which set out to gain European knowledge, still wearing Orthodox dress. Peter and his entire entourage returned looking completely different, all shaved. But his shaved face wasn't the issue. The man who returned was a Westerner. He only wore Western-style clothing, never again put on normal Russian-style clothing, but even his royal vestments. Even if it was the real Peter who returned, a monarch that could be so easily influenced like that is a liability. Another scholar who accepts this, let me take that back. He doesn't accept it, but he gives us a lot of information on it. Andrei Nartov, who wrote memorable stories and speeches of Peter the Great. He stated this with awe in favor of Peter. He said, has anyone ever heard or read in any legends that any autocrat, upon ascending his throne, relinquishing the crown and scepter, and entrusting the governance of the kingdom to his close nobles, would undertake a distant reign in foreign lands solely for the purpose of educating himself in the sciences and the arts, meeting with other sovereigns, verbally discussing mutual benefits and alliances, establishing friendship and harmony, and getting to know their government? That is strange. Well, the mission concluded August 25th, 1698, and almost no one who left initially with the Grand Embassy returned. Exactly 1 month later, the same mysterious masked prisoner, known as Michael or Michel, appeared in the Bastille. Well, it's very close to Mikhailov. I mean, a highly educated man left for Europe. The Peter who came to Russia couldn't remember a thing about all the sciences he had been taught as a member of the Russian high nobility. Militarily speaking, the Tsar had no interest in water. We talked about that already. But as a land power, he only really had an understanding of infantry conquest and tactics, mounted battle. Peter had never even seen naval battles before. He returned from Europe with an excellent conception of boarding and even marine skills. Boarding is something that you have to do it. It can only be experienced in actual naval battles, years of training beforehand. I mean, pirates knew it very well, right? But 2 years or a year and a half or a year or 9 months spent in a shipyard as a craftsman would not have permitted these skills to be mastered. The man who returned, his main language was Dutch. Another documentary by Danilov and Guvenkov. No letters written by Peter before 1687 have survived. Alexei Mihailovich, Peter's father, instituted a regulation requiring every day of the Tsar's life be recorded, which is easy to do since it's ritualized. Between 1672 and 1697, those daily records of the ruler's life went missing. Even his signature changed. Initially, it was Petrus, and now it's Peter. Letters from 1698 onward were marked by near illiteracy. And it's hard to talk about his letters. I mean, a few survived when he was abroad, but many of them have not survived, or at least have been altered. The damage done to Russia by this possible foreigner was extraordinary. He altered the secession law by appointment, not from father to son. In other words, whoever Peter chose would become the new Tsar. And that concept led to the number of palace coups and conspiracies years later. Thank God it was calm in the 19th century. It's said that Peter didn't know the location of Ivan the Terrible's library. It was in a secret location under the Kremlin. It was passed down to all Tsars. Even Peter's sister, Princess Sophia, knew and visited the place. He wanted to locate it immediately after returning from the Grand Embassy. He even conducted excavations at the Kremlin, but he couldn't find it. Now, this library is interesting. This library is a collection of ancient Greek, Latin, and Egyptian manuscripts believed to have been hidden by Tsar Ivan IV. Hundreds of volumes, rare work from Constantinople, after its after its conquest, kept in secret Kremlin vaults. And the library, by the way, has never been found. But Peter didn't know where it was, even though he should have. The library comes from Sophia Palaiologos, the grandmother of Ivan IV, who brought a vast, she was a Greek woman from Byzantium, a vast, valuable collection from Constantinople to Moscow in 1472. A lot of unique ancient masterpieces, including works of Roman literature. I mean, 142 volumes of Livy, we're told. It was referenced by St. Maxim the Greek, so it certainly existed at some point. It shouldn't shock you to know that when the false Peter returned, the Tsar of this man avoided any meetings with any close relatives, eliminating many of them. He didn't attend any weddings or funerals. He needed to live. That's one of the reasons he created St. Petersburg. Peter did not recognize people who had been close to him since childhood, former teachers and servants. His closest associates, people like Gordon and Lefort, died in unknown circumstances, men who knew Peter for some time. Eventually, those who had known Peter for some time met a rough death. Could this be the fear of exposure? The surviving records of the Preobrazhensky Prikaz, which is the predecessor of the secret chancery, and the Russian State Archive of Ancient Documents, paint a curious picture. 90% of state criminals of the day were not necessarily conspirators, traitors, or rebels, but rather those who spoke of the Tsar as not a real Tsar. They posed the greatest danger. And the largest number of these imprisonments and killings occurred just within the first couple of years of his return, when the fear of possible, identification was particularly strong. Now, the mechanics of this, of when and why he was taken and substituted, it's a separate issue. In The Great Pretender, which is a book by Evgeny Baida, Baida is the Ukrainian name, He talks about a few things that occurred at the during his year and a half or 2 years abroad. I'm quoting him here. September 11, 1697, Peter had a secret meeting with King William III of England. Nothing is known about the negotiations except that they lasted 2 hours, and they ended in a friendly way. At the time, the English Navy was known as the fastest in the world. King William assured Peter that he should visit the English naval shipyards, where he would learn to understand ship construction, carry out measurements and calculations, and learn to use instruments and tools. As soon as he arrived in England, he tried to sail on the Thames. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that even if it was secret, I'm sure a few people knew. And when it got out, it may have frightened the French, and certainly the Swedes. Bida also says that, you know, this very young man, like 28, whatever he was, he returns as a sickly man of 40, roughly. Again, he never wore his royal ceremonial title, including the very famous crown of Monomach. That's the very triangular one. Going back to Guillaume and Rousse, I'm sure you've seen a picture of it sometime or another. It was simply too small for him. But Tsar Peter, before he left, wore it all the time. This Peter who returned did not speak Russian very well. He never learned to write it. And any city that he founded or captured were given German names, as were all government and military positions. And he bequeathed to his descendants that they marry exclusively into northern German families. And for 200 years it was observed. This suggests that what comes after, that the Romanov line was as much German and Danish as it was Russian, even more so. The treatment of Eudoxia, who was from the royal family of Lupakina, is curious. I mentioned her already. They were very close before. The first place she was sent was the Suzdal Monastery. The clergy didn't like this. They didn't like this at all. Although I have the feeling she was better off there. Eudoxia and her son, Peter II, became the center of opposition to Peter's reforms. It was in his sermons, St. Dmitry of Rostov, who was referred to Eudoxia as our great sovereign and prophesied her impending return to the throne. Now, that conservative party was destroyed in 1718 during the prosecution and murder of the Tsarevich Alexei, as I've already alluded to. Many, many purges of the church, especially connected to her and to him, were executed. Eudoxia was not. She was transferred to a convent in Lugoda and then eventually to the Schisselberg Fortress, where she died in 1731, along with his sister, Maria. Let's say half of this is true. It has to be explained. His language, his habits, his personality. There's no mention of Peter before he left on the embassy that he spoke fluent Dutch. But in a year and a half, you're not going to pick it up in such a way that you could speak it without an accent. I understand he may pick up a sentence here or there, but not like that. I mean, some people say, well, the clothing, the traditional attire didn't fit him properly. You know, but they still could have made larger ones. But no, he didn't want it. Now, as we all know, Peter wanted to expand Russia's territory, and for legitimate reasons, advancing south towards the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. One of the main goals of the embassy, as I've said, to achieve an alliance against Turkey. The returning Tsar began a struggle for the Baltic coast. The Tsar's war with Sweden was necessary for the Western powers, who wanted to crush her growing power, using Russia for that end. In other words, his foreign policy was based on the interests of Poland, Saxony, and Denmark. Despite the fact that you had constant rage of the Crimean Khans, even at this point, on Moscow, there were a constant threat. The Crimean Khans were a client state of the Ottoman Empire. So it's obvious that a struggle with Turkey is a far more important objective than anything in the Baltic. Now his son, Tsarevich Alexei Petrovich, fled. He had many, many, many good reasons to flee. He fled in 1716. He awaited the death of Peter. He was in Austria. Somewhere within either Austria or the German land. But there's also the concept that he may have went to the Bastille to try to free him from there. One of the great, best-known promoters of this theory is Gleb Nosovsky, Fomenko, very, very famous historians, new chronology historians, which, by the way, can be bizarre, but occasionally interesting and worthwhile. Now, Peter, or false Peter, sent, and this is, I think, a mainstream understanding, sent his agents to find him. And they did. And when they did, they were very nice to him. They said, look, Peter is gravely ill. You'll be able to assume the throne yourself. There's many loyal troops awaiting him in Russia to support you. Don't worry, there's not going to be any prosecution. And of course, he learned the hard way. He believed them. And he died a very nasty death. Something else which is odd. There's a few odd things going along with this theory. Fomenko and Nosovsky studied an exact replica of Ivan the Terrible's throne, which is still in use at the time. Thrones were decorated with the zodiac signs of the current rulers. Studying the signs on Ivan the Terrible's throne, these men discovered that the actual date of birth differs, in Peter's case, from the official version by 4 years. This is part of the new chronology. They discovered Peter's birthday is May 30th. Does not coincide with his name day, which is a huge discrepancy. Baptismal names were given exclusively according to the calendar of saints. Based on the table, they discovered the real name corresponding to Peter's official birthday was Isaac, which was the main cathedral in St. Petersburg. You have a lot of people. Pavel Milyukov also accepts this. There's too many discrepancies here. Now, Milyukov says that the Tsar, yes, he was an imposter, but the kidnapping was carried out by a group of Germans, a group of foreigners, and some of these men arrived in Russia with the new Peter, and that the rumors of the Tsar's substitution were everywhere in Russia. Most of the army, and obviously the old believers, and you more pious regular Orthodox too. Now, you would think you could just examine the biographies, within his lifetime. or right afterwards, to try to get, you know, try to get your brain around this thing. But there's a problem here. Let me read from Nosovsky. Persistent rumors circulated among the people about Peter's non-Russian origins. He was called Antichrist, a German foundling. The difference between Tsar Alexei and his son was so striking that many historians suspected Peter's non-Russian origins. In other words, he was a different person. Moreover, the official version of Peter's background was too unconvincing. It left and leaves more questions than answers. Many researchers have attempted to lift the curtain on the strange omissions surrounding the Peter the Great phenomenon. However, all of these attempts immediately fell under the strictest taboo of the ruling house of Romanov. The phenomenon of Peter has remained unsolved. So the common people, the Cossacks especially, who were, you know, all believers to begin with, maintained that Peter had been replaced. And you had plenty of historians at the time who believed the same. Let me continue with what he said. Inexplicably, until the mid-19th century, not a single work offering a complete history of Peter the Great was published. The first to undertake a full scholarly historical biography of Peter was a remarkable Russian historian, Nikolai Ustrilov. In the introduction of his book, The History of the Reign of Peter the Great, he explains in detail why, to his day, a scholarly work on the history of Peter remains absent. According to him, as early as 1711, Peter was eager to obtain the history of his reign and entrusted this mission to Benedict Schilling, a translator of the Ambassadorial College. He was provided with all the necessary materials and archives, but the work was never published. Not a single page survived. The Russian Tsar had every right to be proud. Oh, this is, you know, 19th century here. He had every right to be proud of his exploits and to wish to convey to posterity the memory of his deeds in their true, unadorned form. His intention was undertaken by Feofan Prokopovich and Baron Husin, tutor to the Tsarevich Alexei at one point. Again, they were provided with official materials, as is evident from Feofan's work, but this never showed up. Feofan sat on it. There were a few chapters here and there. It was written by him very quickly, saying nothing about anything about the embassy. Houston's work, too, was unsatisfactory. It was never published anyway. He had the authentic journals, the campaigns and travels. He limited himself to excerpts up to 1715 without any connection, entangling of any trivialities, but nothing that really anyone could use. Neither this biography nor any subsequent ones were ever published, of course, until our era. The author concludes, the strictest censorship of all historical research, which continued into the 19th century, thus the work of Ustrilov himself, which is the first scientific historiography of Peter the First, was subjected to the harshest censorship. Of the ten volume set that was planned, only separate excerpts from four volumes remain. Really, it comes down to a few pages. It was finally published in an abridged version in 1863. Today, it's lost. The Acts of Peter the Great by Ivan Golikov has not been reprinted since the 19th century. And one of Peter's associates and his personal craftsman, Andrei Nodatov, he wrote, authentic narratives and speeches of Peter the Great, which I've alluded to already, were first uncovered and published only in 1819 and in a tiny print run in a little-known journal called Son of the Fatherland. Even that edition was subject to unprecedented editing, with 74 of the 162 narratives published. It was never reprinted again in the Tsarist era. The original was lost. Another one. Alexander Kass, in his book called The Fall of the Empire of the Russian Tsars, 1675 to 1700, which of course is very telling, implying that the establishment of the empire of a non-Russian Tsar, in other words, implying a substitution. Chapter 9 is called How the Tsar's Dynasty Was Massacred Under Peter, but doesn't really talk about the false Peter whatsoever. So, in this era, in Peter's lifetime, after it, even within the 19th century, in the Tsarist era, old Russia, a full historical biography of Peter was nowhere to be found. Everyone else had one, or many. So let's get back to the basics here. It's unfortunate. We know that when people go for information on something, it's unfortunate they go to Wikipedia. The only thing Wikipedia is good for, in my opinion, is sometimes they give a lot of great sources. That's been very helpful to me in the past, otherwise. But they're always faithful to the party line. And here's what the Russian Wikipedia article says. It is claimed that Peter's double was an experienced sailor who participated in many naval battles and sailed extensively in the southern seas. Sometimes even that he was a sea pirate. Sergei Saul believes that the imposter was a high-ranking Dutch Freemason and a relative of William of Orange, King of Holland and Great Britain. The most commonly cited version, the double's real name was Isaac. We already mentioned that. According to Dmitry Baida, the double was of Swedish or Danish origin and was most likely a Lutheran in religion. Baida, as I mentioned before, does argue that he was the man in the Iron Mask. The prisoner was listed under the name Marshall, or various pronunciations of it, sort of like Mihailov, but just as a Frenchman would write it. As I've said before, the description is very similar to something. You know, someone that tall was pretty rare at the time, and that he was eventually murdered there. Now, here's what Wikipedia has to say about it. Whenever you want to know what the mainstream line is, Wikipedia is a great first start. Here's what they say. The Iron Mask was a mysterious prisoner, numbered 6438900, different number, by the way, during the reign of Louis XIV, who was held in various prisons, including the Bastille, and wore a velvet mask. Then later legends changed it to an iron one. Now, there were suspects, as I've mentioned, of who that might be. The illegitimate son of Louis XIV, maybe. Louis de Valery, who allegedly slapped the half-brother of the Grand Dauphin, who atoned for this guilt by internal imprisonment. Quite implausible, since the real Louis died in 1683 at age 16. Now, Voltaire, as far as you can go with him, the Iron Mask was the twin brother of Louis XIV. So you have a million different hypotheses out there. Dutch writers suggested that the Iron Mask was a foreigner, young nobleman, chamberlain to Queen Anne of Austria, the real father of Louis XIV. The man in the Iron Mask was the Duke Francois de Beaufort. That claim was refuted in Allaire's History of the Fronde, and a whole bunch of other theories have been put forth. However, the facts are this. The timing of the substitution of Tsar Peter, let's say August of 1698, coincided with the appearance of a prisoner in the Iron Mask, or a mask, in the Bastille, September of 1698, and also with a new commandant of the Bastille, Saint-Mars, that I mentioned before. He died in 1703. After his death, the room where he was kept which was, you know, fairly well appointed for a prison cell, was searched, and all traces of his presence were destroyed. Now take what you want out of this. Whether he was a man in the Iron Mask or not is completely separate from whether or not he, the man who returned with the handful of people who left in the Grand Embassy, was not in fact Peter. But we know what Peter did. He got rid of the Streltsy. He got rid of the Cossacks. So in other words, he had to form an army along European lines. So he recruited military personnel from the European, everywhere in Northern Europe, and granting these men enormous benefits and privileges, way above your typical Russian officer. And it wasn't just that. There was a deeply Freemasonic element to it, because these foreigners despised everything Russian, mocked the peasants, who were forced into the army by the monarch's will. The dominance of the foreigners in the army, civil service, and even education. This was a new Russia, a new aristocracy, and the common people. Using Cossack troops was a problem, because they also tended to be old believers, and they didn't believe that this was the real Tsar. You know, people like to use cliches. I try to avoid them by any means. And then one stupid cliche is that Peter cut a window to Europe, securing Russia's access to the Gulf of Finland after the Swedish War. But at the same time, remember, that would also mean that Europe cut a window into Moscow. Before Peter, foreign access to Muscovy was very limited. The right to cross the border was granted to ambassadors, a handful of merchants, and a very small number of travelers. Under Peter, you had crowds of adventurers and Jewish speculators flocked to the capital. And they were all granted enormous privileges and advantages. The true Russian aristocracy was pushed aside. But this cost money. To maintain an army of this size and create the navy that he created requires enormous funds. By the way, a lot of which was immediately stolen. The foreigners stole the bulk of the money. We talked about this much after Peter's death, what happened under Byron, etc. Many of these foreigners that Peter had brought in were, they may have been of noble birth, they were still poor. They were descended from impoverished noble families, or were like second, third, with no hope of inheritance. Second, third son with no hope of inheritance. They grabbed whatever they could and returned to their homeland. You know, the question I had coming across this is, why would you need an embassy like this to put a coalition together against Turkey? And then why couldn't craftsmen, like is what occurred under Tsar Alexei, why could craftsmen not just simply be imported? Why was this travel necessary? And under this you know, all this pomp, you know, I mean, I think it was far larger. I think it was about 200 people who left. Except the actual Tsar of Russia leaving is going to be a lot of people. But whatever the real number is, certainly it wasn't necessary to put a coalition together, or even to learn the arts of the Dutch or anyone else. It is conceivable that the Grand Embassy was planned in advance by Lefort and other acquaintances of Peter. Not so much with the desire to replace him, but to bring him into Western politics and Western reality. It's possible that other circumstances arose that facilitated Peter's capture. I mean, for one thing, the dispersal of his retinue. I mean, they weren't killed. I mean, some people say they were killed. I don't think that was true. Some just stayed at taverns, some to girls, some to doctors, some to resorts. I think the group was more like 200. But after a short time, that was reduced to almost nothing. Capturing the Tsar became a pretty easy matter. And I also think that Peter, the real Peter, his intransigence on principled stand on political and religious issues, pushed the monarchs that hosted him to anger. But that's speculation. Poland wanted all of Ukraine as a payment for their possible war against Turkey. Any of this could have caused a severe problem. The truth is that the case for his kidnapping, regardless of the problems with the reasons, the mechanics, or where he ended up, the case for the kidnapping is fairly strong, but not invincible. It's also a separate issue that a different man came back than the man who left. Yeah, that the evidence there is strong. The radical changes to his physicality, to his personality. I've seen so many paintings roughly around this time, before and after, and they don't look alike. With a painting in Holland, the very beginning of his visit, it looks like his father, Alexei, which makes sense, of course. But afterwards, even shortly afterwards, it does not. It bears no resemblance to that painting. Again, this is an age prior to photography, before electronics, for any kind of surveillance. The fact that he grew taller is a bizarre thing. Portrait painters often inscribe certain things within the canvas. So in one of Peter's later paintings, the inscription Anatoly from Ankara is clearly visible. That's how they would put their own descriptions within the painting itself. Now, I've looked at these paintings. I've never seen them in person, though. Baida is one of the ones who promotes this. So just on my laptop, it's probably not good enough to make a judgment. So is this Anatoly? By the way, the retinue that he left with, however large, remains a mystery. Because Peter never said a word. Convincing one person of a substitution for either than convincing 200 or whatever the number. The man who returned severed contact with everybody and all relatives who may have suspected the substitution. The only one who took action was Sophia. She had other reasons to take action, too. I'm not saying it was just for that, but that may well have been an issue. The treatment of his wife, although again, I think she was better off not being in this man's presence. The rulers, Peter's speech was normal Russian before. The man who came back was very slurred, heavy European accent. He knew Russian sort of, at best. So after his wife was exiled, Peter or Anatoly, whoever the heck it is, found someone else who wasn't even remotely of noble descent. He stole her from his very corrupt subordinate Menshikov, who in turn similarly stole a woman from a member of the lower ranks. I guess this is apparently how it went, which is quite uncharacteristic of an Orthodox Tsar, especially the very Orthodox Tsar who was the man who left prior to, who left in the embassy, not the man who came back. And we all know who he eventually took up with, the illiterate Baltic prostitute, making her Empress Catherine I. Her real name was Marta Skavronskaya. That was his insult to the royal family. That was his insult to Russian tradition. When Peter died, and this so-called Catherine I took over, that's when Menshikov became the de facto ruler of the Russian Empire. Mainstream historians will talk about Peter's knowledge of naval combat, even the combat we would call of a Marine Corps, which could not have occurred. And any records that survive from his embassy don't mention any of it. Now, a year and a half, you can't do it this way. I mentioned boarding, there's a few other things. Sometimes we see this in movies, but it was a very specific military, naval, marine tactic that took quite a bit of training to learn. Well, by the time of his death, whoever he was, in 1725, or actually the year 7233, Peter had drastically changed the calendar. The Petrian Revolution had reduced Muscovy to a dire economic state. Tremendous hardship was brought to the Russian people. It was a yoke. Now, I saw a map, 1717. It was actually, you know, during the reign of Peter. The dominions were certainly larger than any European country, but not the Russian Empire as presented to us by normal Russian historians. In the east, the border runs along the western spurs of the Ural Mountains and nothing beyond it. This map that I saw shows two Novgorod cities, Novgorod, the one in Lake Lugoda, and the one in the Volga. And Moscow, of course, creates this so-called Golden Ring. Anatoly Fomenko tends to believe that the capital of this was not Moscow, but Novgorod. On the map, even Moscow is not highlighted in the same way that Novgorod is. It suggests to me that, of course, they wanted to expand this dominion. It was very large to begin with. But it was planned in advance. People like Lefort and many others, other acquaintances of Peter. Again, not to overthrow him, but to become a European empire, not an Orthodox state. But there's very good reason for them wanting him gone anyway. The dispersal of his retinue is very clear. It's almost humorous how that occurred. I don't want to speculate too much, but we have no choice here. You know, it is worth talking about. Oh, another great writer here is Karpushchenko. False Peter, Scaffold for the Empire, which came out in M4, a publishing house in 2000. There's a bunch of good historians in Russia and Ukraine that accept this thesis. They are a tiny minority. I'm not sure if I'm one of them. Again, it certainly has precedent. False monarchs even reigned, as I mentioned, caused all kinds of problems. This is an age where you can get away with this kind of thing. Yes, the argument is substantial. I am somewhat moved by it, but it's certainly not an airtight argument. And I bring this all up because, of course, I'm in the middle of writing a book on why Peter the Great was evil and how, and the Masonic core of all of this stuff. I may include this as an appendix. I'm going to just assume that this was the same man But there has to be explanations to everything else, and I'm not getting those. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.